From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the letter that stated, "We wish to inform you that tomorrow we will be killed with our families." We talk with journalist Philip Gurevich about his new book on the 1994 genocide in Rwanda and its aftermath. Also, I talk with William Weld, former governor of Massachusetts and former federal prosecutor. He worked on the Nixon impeachment inquiry and the Iran-Contra investigation. Weld is a Republican who has broken rank with his party on gay rights and abortion. He's temporarily out of politics, but has written a new political novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says substantial progress was made today during three-way talks with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The leaders have agreed to meet in Washington a week from tomorrow for a summit with President Clinton to try to work out an agreement on a West Bank accord. NPR's Jennifer Ludden says there's still much work to do.
While Secretary Albright was not at all forthcoming about details of anything that has been agreed to this point, she did give us a list of issues they'd made significant and substantive progress on, she said. These include clearly the 13% drawback of Israeli troops from the West Bank, security issues about cracking down on terrorism. Also, she said there's progress on opening up an airport in the Gaza Strip, which is all ready to go. It just needs Israeli approval. And she says they made progress on forming an anti-incitement committee and people-to-people programs to try and create this atmosphere of cooperation, not just among the political leaders, but among the citizens.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden from the Gaza-Israeli border. Several countries are beginning to advise their citizens in Yugoslavia to get out as quickly as they can. American diplomat Richard Holbrooke is warning Yugoslav authorities that unless they stop repressing ethnic Albanian Yugoslavs who live in Kosovo, a decisive moment will get closer. Holbrooke is again trying to persuade the president of Yugoslavia to remove security troops from Kosovo. These troops have been implicated in several massacres of unarmed civilians. President Clinton says each House Democrat should decide for him or herself tomorrow when lawmakers will choose whether an impeachment inquiry into the president's behavior will move forward. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The House votes tomorrow on whether or not to proceed with an open-ended, wide-ranging impeachment inquiry of the president. Republicans have the votes to prevail, but the White House would like to keep Democratic defections to a minimum to bolster their argument that the process is driven by partisan politics. The president has been warned not to pressure Democrats, and today he made clear he's not twisting arms.
I think everybody should cast a vote of principle and conscience.
In private, the president has told members that polls show a majority of Americans do not want him removed from office. But Democrats know that the polls also show the majority of people likely to vote in November are more conservative and favor impeachment hearings. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
John Glenn is doing a launch rehearsal today at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. The Ohio senator has joined six astronauts who will blast into space with him later this month aboard the Discovery Shuttle. Glenn was the first American to orbit the Earth in 1962. Now he is prepared to become the oldest person to enter space. Glenn is 77. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 15 points at 7,757. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, after bouncing around, the U.S. stock market seems to have found some reason for a little optimism. Much of it seems to stem from Japan's announcement that the government has made progress towards solving that country's banking crisis. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
While investors dissected an address by Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan to a group of economists meeting today in Washington, the stock market decided instead to focus its attention on Japan. The Japanese market posted its biggest rise of the year today, closing up 6%. That was ahead of an announcement from the country's Liberal Democratic Party that had sent a bank bailout plan calling for the injection of public funds to the country's parliament. Mr. Greenspan, meanwhile, told members of the National Association for Business Economics that while the U.S. economy is expected to slow next year, it also remains in good shape. Internet stocks moved higher today. That followed news that German publisher Bertelsmann AG will invest $200 million in the online bookselling division of Barnes & Noble. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
White House officials and Republican leaders are meeting today to try to head off a budget dispute. Each side has blamed the other for talk of another possible government shutdown. The clock is ticking. A stopgap spending bill runs out this Friday. Lawmakers also want to get home to campaign for re-election. But several thorny issues must first be resolved. These include how the 2000 census would be taken and whether to help out the International Monetary Fund. IBM is hooking up with French Telecom. The American computer manufacturer will supply the French National Telephone Company with software and services intended to bring global net access to about 15 million French online subscribers. Currently, France's online subscription uses a screen and a keyboard instead of a personal computer. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 1 year after the genocide in Rwanda, journalist Philip Gurevich made his first in a series of trips there. He says he wanted to know how Rwandans understood what had happened in their country and how they were getting on in the aftermath. Gurevich wrote about Rwanda for The New Yorker, where he's a staff writer. Now he's written a new book called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, Stories from Rwanda. The genocide began when the Hutu-led government of Rwanda called on the Hutu majority to murder everyone in the Tutsi minority. Last month, the former prime minister of Rwanda became the first person in history to be convicted for the crime of genocide by an international court. The UN War Crimes Tribunal gave him life in prison. I ask Gurevich to give us a sense of the genocide's proportions.
The best estimates are that at least 800,000 Rwandans, one-tenth of the population, were killed in a period of about 100 days. If you boil that down, that actually comes to the extraordinary statistic of 5.5 people a minute murdered every minute over a period of 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, week after week, for 10 weeks, at least 100 days. And it's a kind of staggering speed of just simple slaughter.
When you got to Rwanda, one of the places you went to was a church that has become almost a genocide memorial. Would you describe what you saw there?
Well, this is a church in eastern Rwanda, and it sits on a little hilltop, as so many Rwandan hilltops have churches on top of them. And it looks essentially, or looked at the time, from a distance, very much like any church anywhere on a hilltop, a kind of nice brick Italianate cathedral. And as one came up to it, the only thing that was striking is that it seemed a little bit overgrown around it. And then entering some of the outbuildings, the floor was simply covered in corpses, mostly somewhat decomposed corpses. And this had been a place where hundreds, perhaps thousands of people had sought refuge from the surrounding community when the massacres began in April of 1994. And this was something that happened nationwide. People who were endangered, targeted, slated for death, that is to say, all Tutsis and any number of Hutus who might have been intermarried with Tutsis or who felt that their political opposition to the ruling party that was ordaining these massacres made them also targets for death. They fled seeking sanctuary in places like churches, public places like schools, government offices, sometimes stadia. And they hoped that in concentration like this, they would find sanctuary. In this church, and the church that we're speaking about is called Nyarabuye, the mayor of that area had instructed the local Tutsi population, well, maybe you'll be safer if you go to the church. And several days later, he had led the militia bands of Hutu power militia to slaughter the Tutsis who had sought refuge there. And the government later, when it had discovered this church, the new government of Rwanda, the people who were now governing after the genocide, had decided to leave it, as they had found it, with the bodies strewn about as a commemorative site. And it was quite a graphic way to recognize just the scope of what it means to have 100, 1,000, 2,000 people killed. And then you think about numbers like 800,000, because when you're in a place like that, it really does seem like there are dead people everywhere.
You make a point in your book that the genocide wasn't about chaos, it wasn't about anarchy. The genocide was very well orchestrated. It was the product of order, the product of authoritarianism. Can you explain how the word was gotten out?
The word to do the killing?
Yeah.
The idea that it was time to kill the Tutsis, the orders, as it were gotten out through many levels. One of the main levels was the radio. There was a long history in Rwanda by 1994 of state-sponsored hostility and animosity towards the Tutsi population, including periodic massacres, the idea that a Tutsi life was quite deeply devalued by the time that the genocide began. At that point, the local administrators were receiving encouragement, shall we say, from their higher-ups. And there's a very hierarchical political and social structure in Rwanda. And really, at all levels, it was disseminating outwards to the smaller and smaller localer and localer units that this was, it was now a time of killing. And a message that had sort of been a rather conventional us-or-them attitude of ethnic division became a kill-or-be-killed message. And there had been long structuring and training of the militia bands throughout the country. Now, simultaneously, you had the radio encouraging the struggle, encouraging what was called cleaning the bush, do your work. These were the sorts of euphemisms that were used for describing the extermination of the Tutsi population. At the same time as you had that, you had local leaders encouraging people. You had state figures from the government. You had the prime minister. You had all of the various ministers in the cabinet and the president himself, the acting president at the time, traveling around the country, leading rallies, congratulating people in places where massacres had taken place for work well done, and encouraging those in places where the massacres had yet to be completed to do their work. And the extent of this, although it's hard to find, for instance, a tape recording of somebody saying, kill all the Tutsis now, you would have these euphemisms like, do your work, or eliminate the enemies of the people, and so forth. These were completely clearly understood and had a long legacy. And so the message was really disseminated very intensively at very many different levels, both by example and by word of mouth.
Since this was a kind of general population massacre where everybody was encouraged to do the killing, and most of these people were unarmed, it wasn't a professional army with armed soldiers, what were the methods that were used for the genocide? I know machetes were very often used. What else was done?
Machetes, clubs, hoes, in other words, garden tools. Virtually everybody in Rwanda has a machete, and they don't have it for chopping up their neighbors, as people might imagine here from the sort of press coverage. It's the all-purpose tool. People use it. It's an agrarian culture. It's basically a peasant culture. You see people walking everywhere with machetes. They cut their firewood with it. They cut their grass with it. They dig holes with it. They build their houses with it. They use it for just about everything. So it's a ubiquitous tool. Nevertheless, in the months preceding the massacres, there have been documented sort of large orders were made by the government on behalf of the militias to stockpile machetes. They were ordering them from China. They were ordering them from their own factories that were manufacturing machetes locally. So that there was a clear effort to make sure that the population was armed, even in this rudimentary fashion. And then a few people with guns or a few people with hand grenades could easily sort of create the militarized context that was needed to spur on the population.
You write that most of the dogs were shot during the genocide. Why?
Well, this was a peculiar side effect. They were really shot after the genocide. I had noticed when I was in Rwanda that there were very, very, very few dogs, and it was very quiet at night, and that's not very typical of outdoor countries, shall we say, places where a lot of the life is taking place in a temperate climate outdoors. The Rwandan dogs were eating the Rwandan dead. And as the rebel army, the Rwandese Patriotic Front, that liberated Rwanda from the genocide, moved across the country, taking territory, they began to shoot the dogs that they saw eating the dead. essentially in disgust and fury. These dogs were, nobody wanted this such a dog around anymore, and so they were killed. And it really tells you of kind of, there's something about this image which I found particularly lurid and sad, in the sense that it, the dogs were made masterless by the killing. Masterless, they ran loose and ate their masters. And it tells you how deeply a society is torn apart when even the dogs can't be left to survive.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Philip Gurevich, and his new book is called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, Stories from Rwanda. And he's reported on Rwanda for The New Yorker. Some of the priests in Rwanda joined in the genocide, and you spoke to one of the reverends who was alleged to have participated in it. In fact, he was indicted by the War Crimes Tribunal. And I'm thinking of Reverend Ntake Rudimana. Tell us what he told you. Did he admit to any of the charges?
No. Pastor Elizaphan Ntake Rudimana was the president of the Adventist Church in the western Rwandan province of Kibuye, which is a beautiful mountainous area along the edge of Lake Kivu, which forms the border with what was then Zaire and is now the Congo. He was the president of the Adventist Church for the entire province, and there he lived in a town called Mugenero. And I had traveled out to Kibuye when I was in Rwanda in the summer of 96, and I visited Mugenero, and there I spoke with a number of survivors who described how, as in the church massacre site that I described earlier at Nyarubuye, people from the area, fearing death, Tutsis had fled, seeking refuge at the church center. And as they amassed there, they began to fear that they themselves would be massacred, and began to hear rumors that they were being directed there to be massacred, not to be saved. Amongst their number were seven Tutsi pastors, who were members of the Adventist Church, church authorities, and when they learned that on a particular Saturday morning they were to be killed, they wrote a letter to Pastor Ntake Rudimana, the Hutu church president, asking that he intercede on their behalf. And it's from that letter, actually, that I take the title of my book, We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families. They were asking him in that strange, formal, polite, deferential language to intercede on their behalf and save their lives. And the story I heard in Mugenero was that, in fact, he had said something to the effect of, well, no, you must die. God no longer wants you, which I thought were particularly chilling words. And then I learned that he was living in Laredo, Texas, of all places. He had a son who some years ago had become a doctor in the United States and was living in Laredo, Texas. And Pastor Ntake Rudimana had fled after the genocide into Zaire and then into Zambia. And from Zambia, he had immigrated with a green card to the United States. And so I went down to Laredo and I tracked him down, or I tracked down the son, and through him was able to meet the father, who wanted to speak to me, I represented a reporter at that point, because he claimed he wanted to clear his good name. And he claimed that far from having helped or orchestrated the massacre, at that point he was under indictment from the War Crimes Tribunal. I knew it, he didn't. It was a secret indictment that I had learned about. He said, well, you know, it was a time of chaos. It was a time of anarchy. I never did anything that I've been accused of. In fact, his alibi, which was a rather extraordinary alibi, he said, I went, when the killing in my town began, I went to the next town over, and the quote was, where they had killed everybody, and so there was peace. It's a strange way of defining peace, I thought, for a man of God who was also accused of massacring his own congregation. And it was odd. I had heard about this letter, and I asked him about it, and he told me the story that, yes, indeed, he'd received such a letter, but there was nothing he could do. And then I said, well, what exactly did the letter say? Because up until then, I had really been told about it only by survivors in Rwanda. And he told me, well, here. And he handed me a copy of the letter. He'd kept the letter for all this time. What I've never been able to understand is, did he think it exonerated him? Because in many ways, it seems to raise more doubts about his role than it answers. He was arrested the day after I met him at that point in Laredo, Texas, by the FBI on this indictment from the UN tribunal. And he spent a good deal of time in a Laredo jail fighting his extradition to the United Nations Tribunal, which sits in Arusha, Tanzania. He hired Ramsey Clark, the former attorney general, and managed through very strange decision from a local magistrate in Laredo to be freed. He's since been retaken into custody, presumably awaiting extradition. But it gives a sense also of how widespread this was. It was something that infiltrated the deepest levels of church hierarchies and that also fans out then quickly into the entire world.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Philip Gurevich. His new book is about the Rwandan genocide. It's called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Philip Gurevich. He's a journalist who's written about Rwanda for The New Yorker. His new book is about the Rwandan genocide and its aftermath. It's called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families. Most of the people who carried out the genocide in Rwanda were just regular people. They weren't part of a trained fighting force. You can't say they were indoctrinated while they were in the military to become fighting machines or killing machines, because they weren't, most of them, in the military. I know you've tried to answer the question, how can regular people participate in a genocide? What kind of answers or conclusions have you been able to come up with?
I can explain and describe and account for any number of factors which contribute to what appear to be the pattern of behavior once on Rwanda. But in the end, I have to say I'm left somewhat mystified and dissatisfied. And I made it I decided that there are some things where one has to respect the mystery, even the mystery of this kind of an atrocity. But there's an example that I think is very interesting. I once was stuck on a road late at night and in the darkness in Rwanda, and a car broke down and I was stuck out there. And suddenly there was a woman screaming in the valley down below, and this screaming got picked up by everybody around. I couldn't see anything. It was in the darkness down below. And one heard this tremendous hubbub in a little village. And after about an hour, some soldiers came up on the road leading a prisoner. And it turned out that this man had broken into the woman who had screamed. He'd broken into her house and assaulted her, apparently trying to rape her. And I was told that in Rwanda, in village by village, in the small communities and larger, when you're offended, when somebody attacks you, when you call for help, everybody else is supposed to pick up this call and also come running to your assistance. And if you don't help out in this way, you yourself are considered a bit of an accomplice. And it was explained to me as totally normal. Well, of course, isn't this how it is where you live? I mean, this is community. And what happened in Rwanda is that idea of community was turned on its head. If you didn't run to help in the killing, you were an accomplice. If you didn't participate in slaughtering, then you were the one who had to explain yourself. And so this very tight community system was used to purge the Tutsi population.
I think it's fair to say that most Americans can't keep straight the Hutus from the Tutsis. What separates them in Rwanda?
Relatively little, except a legacy of distorted identity politics, I think it's fair to say. Nobody knows exactly how these terms originated, where they came from in before recorded history. But at the time of colonization by European explorers, which was really only about 100 years ago in the 1890s, there were these groups called Hutu and some called Tutsi within Rwandan society, and it really seems to have been more of a caste or a class division representing economic and social status, the tiny Tutsi minority being an elite. The Europeans manipulated this around ideas that they brought with them of race science, which is to say pseudoscience of racial categorization, and created really ultimately an almost apartheid-like system in Rwanda in which the Tutsi elite were considered a superior master race. They were certain physical stereotypes which made Tutsi tall, skinny, and more European in their features, and therefore, of course, that contributed also to the idea that they were superior in the eyes of Europeans, and the Hutu as a kind of slave or inferior race. The fact of the matter is it's very difficult physically or otherwise to distinguish them, and that modern historians and ethnographers simply reject the idea that they're two distinct groups. They speak the same language, they've worshipped the same gods, and they live together intermingled.
And when Belgium colonized Rwanda, they gave the Tutsis more authority, more power. And then when Rwanda got its independence, the Hutus ousted the Tutsi leaders. So I guess there's a bit of a history of back and forth there between the Hutus and the Tutsis about who was controlling who and who was ousting who.
Well, yeah. I mean, essentially, you had a small elite group, the Tutsi, who enjoyed all the privileges under the colonial state. And then, in the name of majority rule and independence, the Hutu made a bid for power. And it was actually, strikingly, only at that very moment in 1959 that one has the first instance of organized political violence between the two groups, where Hutu and Tutsi were sort of violently clashing. Although one often hears of this as some kind of ancient tribal warfare, there was never before any recorded instance of this kind. And it's essentially a very modern phenomenon. It's one in which political leadership, seeking to create its base, seeking to manipulate its constituency, thrives on creating the bogey of the other group as a sort of mortal enemy and a constant peril. And in this case, in Rwanda, although it's happened differently elsewhere, Hutus had power since 1959, 1960, and cultivated very strongly the idea of this tiny Tutsi minority as a mortal enemy within.
You really don't like the kind of reporting that says, well, this is a story in which there's problems on both sides. It's just one of those historical, intractable messes that's, you know, pretty incomprehensible.
No, I think the nicest thing that can be said about such reporting is that it's lazy and sort of more damagingly, both to our understanding and to the people there in the places, it's wrong. It doesn't seek to really recognize the political forces that are at play that are defining these massive events. It doesn't seek to understand the events in the terms that they themselves are taking place.
Philip Gurevich is the author of a new book about the genocide in Rwanda called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape by the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Buck, an examination of race-sensitive college admission policies and their long-term consequences. In bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with journalist Philip Gurevich about the genocide in Rwanda and its aftermath. Also, what it's like to break rank with your party. We talk with the former governor of Massachusetts, William Weld, a Republican who has supported abortion and gay rights. He's written a political novel.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with journalist Philip Gurevich. He's written a new book about the 1994 genocide in Rwanda and its aftermath. Gurevich is a staff writer for The New Yorker. I asked him about the political events that led to the genocide.
Two things can be said to be form the sort of immediate background to the Rwandan genocide. The first, that between 1990 and 1994, Rwanda was in a state of on again, off again, but continuous civil war in which a predominantly Tutsi, but not exclusively Tutsi, rebel group was opposing the entrenched power, which was known as Hutu power, of the president and his extremist entourage. And then a background within that of sort of very complex political turmoil with many, many Hutu opposition groups. And then most specifically, the interesting thing is that while the background was this war, and it was during this war that the Hutu power extremists who would lead the genocide built up their militia bases, held practice massacres, cultivated the logic, the rhetoric, the propaganda, and the organizational structures that would preside over the genocide. It was only when a peace agreement was struck, a power-sharing arrangement in August of 93, that the Hutu power leaders ratcheted up for what they themselves called the final solution. And it was only when they actually had to share power that they said there is no solution but to completely eliminate those with whom we are being asked to share.
Tens of thousands of people have been arrested for participating in the genocide. Did you visit one of the prisons on any of your trips there?
I'm afraid I visited at least a half a dozen of them. I say afraid because they're really pretty depressing spectacle. You walk in, and the first thing that sort of strikes you is that these are prisons built quite often maybe for 800 people, 1,000 people. They're large brick fortress-looking areas. And you're looking at 10,000, 11,000 people, 6,000 here, 8,000. They're packed into these spaces. They're packed so tightly that they can barely move. They can't all lie down at the same time. They have to sleep in shifts. They sleep sitting up. Many of them are living outdoors perpetually with just a little bit of plastic sheeting as a roof. And so the first thing that strikes one is these are appalling conditions. On the other hand, they are being fed and given medical care and so forth, primarily by international relief groups. And the other thing that strikes one is, my goodness, a great number of these people are accused for a reason. They may not have been properly arrested by the sort of due process that we would hope for in our fairly well-established justice system, but this is the scale of the crime that was committed here, is that these sorts of numbers certainly do correspond to those who are guilty. It doesn't mean that the people who are in prison until they've been tried can be said to be guilty. But that's one of the things that strikes you. And you see them there, and the other thing that's striking is how very passive much of the prison population is. And it was something that was hard to explain, except that there was the feeling that a terrible, terrible crime had been committed, and that it wasn't extraordinary at all to Rwandans that so many people should be in jail.
You write that you think true genocide and true justice are incompatible. Why?
It is impossible to hold anybody to... If one looks at American courts, they couldn't try 100,000 murder trials, much less 800,000 murder trials, with perfect due process and the sort of carrying it out to the degree and the letter of the law that we would require within the lifetimes of the perpetrators. And we have the most lawyer-heavy, law-driven society in the world. In Rwanda, it's even more impossible. It's simply impossible to account for a crime of that magnitude. And that's part of its attraction, I suspect, to its perpetrators, is if everybody's implicated, nobody's implicated. How can you ever hold anybody to account? How can punishment ever suit the crime? It is a crime that in some very, very disturbing way, one has the sense is being gotten away with.
The International War Crimes Tribunal has handed in two convictions so far, one of a former small-town mayor and the other of a former prime minister, the man who was prime minister during the genocide. The former prime minister got life in prison, and he was the first person in history to plead guilty to genocide in a war crimes tribunal. What kind of precedents do you think this war crimes tribunal is setting?
Well, he was the first person to plead guilty to genocide in a war crimes tribunal, but by then Rwanda, in its own courts, had convicted hundreds of people of genocide. So I make the point simply to say Rwanda has been trying people for genocide in the past year and a half. Some of those trials don't meet the sort of standards that we would like them to. Overall, they're remarkably varied sentences coming out of them. That's one way to judge the independence of such a court. The International Tribunal is setting an odd set of precedents. It's hard to know that the prime minister who was convicted confessed, and he confessed in a deal where he was trying to guarantee, he basically said, I will confess in exchange for the protection of my family in exile. And he's been complaining about whether or not they're protected at the level of well-being that he would like them to be. He made a deal, and it was very important both for Rwanda and for this court to have this conviction. I don't think it's not a court that is capable of bringing justice for the Rwandan genocide. It is a court that is capable of doing some pioneering work in international law at a very slow pace that has very little or very delayed bearing on Rwanda's recovery, if one can speak of recovery, from the genocide.
In the meantime, I think about 1 million Hutu people have returned to Rwanda. So this means that the Tutsi and the Hutu who tried to kill them are living together again. And I wonder what kind of interactions you observed.
Well, it's one of the great and bewildering things about Rwanda, and one of the things that I found made the story so fascinating, that actually makes it a story that is so far from being over, and that is, never before has a society that was so divided, that literally one part of the population was called upon to eliminate the other part, and many members of it did participate in so doing, and many people were killed, that the both groups are being asked to live together as neighbors again and to form a society as Rwandans, first of all, and to create some idea of a Rwandan national identity. It's an enormous challenge. What's striking is a lot of people are giving it a go. These categories, Tutsi and Hutu, are more laden with meaning in the aftermath of the bloodletting than ever before. It's only prudent to be suspicious. It's only prudent to be fearful. And it's a huge burden of vengeful feelings that people carry with them. At the same time, one sees a great deal of interacting. I mean, I know many intermarried couples who remain intermarried. What matters ultimately to people is how individuals behaved. And it's the great problem is that it's hard to know. It's hard to know unless you very well do know. In other words, it's hard to know outside your small community. And I think, if anything, it makes people wary of one another very deeply.
You say that your book is in part about how people imagine themselves and one another, and that the book is about how we imagine our world. I'm wondering how reporting on this story and spending time in Rwanda has changed your view of your world.
There's a certain level on which I think it makes me feel that we are all somewhat less safe than we would like to imagine. Not because I think that we're all in immediate danger of being hacked up by our neighbors, but because I think for the 50 years since the Genocide Convention was passed, and certainly in the way that the Holocaust, which is sort of the defining genocide in modern consciousness, has been remembered, there's an increasing tendency to accept the principles, never again, and the world must oppose such things, on a somewhat facile level, which is to say we all stand opposed to genocide after it's happened. But what Rwanda also showed is that the idea that we would act out of a sense of common humanity to defend people before such a slaughter simply doesn't hold up. The world doesn't care to act in these situations. It holds back. And that it means, in some deep way, I think what I saw in Rwanda is to think of these things as humanitarian situations, and to think of them facilely, I think, as sort of we are opposed to them and therefore we behave well, that denouncing evil and acting against evil are not the same, and that these are very complex political things that are taking place, and that if one doesn't look at them as such and seek to unravel them, one is at greater risk, I think, of falling prey to them.
Well, Philip Gurevich, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Philip Gurevich is the author of a new book about the genocide in Rwanda called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. Coming up, we talk about politics with the former governor of Massachusetts and former federal prosecutor, William Weld. This is Fresh Air. My guest William Weld is temporarily out of politics, but he's carefully watching what's happening in the impeachment debate. Weld is a former federal prosecutor. He worked on the Nixon impeachment hearing and the Iran-Contra investigation. He served as the governor of Massachusetts from 1991 to 97, and then made what's been described as one of the most abrupt, astonishing U-turns in recent political history. He challenged the Democratic incumbent John Kerry for a seat in the U.S. Senate and lost. Soon after, President Clinton nominated Weld to serve as ambassador to Mexico. Weld resigned from his position as governor to pursue this new position, but after strong opposition led by Jesse Helms, Weld withdrew his nomination. Now Weld is in private practice. He's written a new political novel called Mackerel by Moonlight. It's about a former federal prosecutor who's elected district attorney in Boston, then has his eye on a Senate seat. Here's a short reading that takes place just after he's become the DA, defeating the incumbent. He's asking his outgoing predecessor for advice.
I had gone to Marty Gross in early December and said I knew he had an administrative first assistant, and I knew he had a legal guy, and I knew he had a press guy. But what I wanted to know was, who was the real guy? Who does your less desirable laundry? Who makes it happen when skies are cloudy and gray? I asked. Gross told me it was this retired Sergeant Potts from the PD who handled the administrative-cum-political stuff and basically covered his flank and rear. Gross urged me to keep him. When you're riding into Dodge City, you don't want to ride in alone, he advised me. You want somebody covering your backside, and you may have to be riding back-to-back to keep an eye on all the Indians. Much obliged, Mr. District Attorney. I will keep this well in mind, I had said.
How does your main character's experiences in politics compare to yours?
Well, most of the main characters in this book are composites of myself, my wife, my press secretaries, my campaign managers, and my political opponents. Certainly much of what Terry learns here is stuff that I learned, and much of his opening agenda was my opening agenda, namely depoliticize the prosecutor's office. But he does some bad stuff here, stuff I'm happy to say I never was obliged to do during my brief career.
Such as?
Well, I'm not going to give away the ending, but let's say not just that mistakes were made, but crimes happened.
William Weld, why did you write a novel?
A novel as opposed to a kiss and tell, you can be much more vicious in fiction. You can tell more in fiction. It's really no holds barred because all the names have been changed to protect the guilty.
Well, you know, now that you've written a novel, I feel I can ask you this. A lot of people are saying that the Bill Clinton Kenneth Starr story reads more like a novel than reality. What do you think?
Nah, nobody would believe it. It wouldn't sell 500 copies.
If it was a novel?
Right.
The House Judiciary Committee vote to proceed with impeachment hearings, that vote was strictly along party lines. I wonder what that says to you.
Well, I don't think the tawdry office affair, even with lying on top of it, is the stuff of impeachment and removal. I mean, many years ago, in 1973-4, I worked on the House Judiciary Committee on the Nixon impeachment hearings. Indeed, there was a fellow worker, a co-worker named Hillary Rodham, and our first assignment, and she and I were two of the first people hired, was to write a memorandum defining what constitutes grounds for impeachment of a president. And, you know, our conclusion was it doesn't have to be a crime. After all, what if the president moved to a foreign country and took up a life of pleasure? That may not be a crime, but he has to be subject to being removed for that. On the other hand, it does have to have something to do with his ability to exercise the duties of his office. So, you know, I think there's a real strong case to be made for the proposition that this is not what the framers had in mind as the basis for removal by the Senate. In that sense, I'm somewhat surprised that the vote was as party line as it was. I would have thought the issue would have been thought to be somewhat more doubtful than that.
I want to get back to your role on the impeachment inquiry for President Nixon, but since the vote was so along party lines, I wonder what it's like for you to be perceived as a Republican who often breaks with the party, someone whose views don't always go along with what's considered traditional Republican views, such as your support of gay rights, abortion.
Well, you know, I break with everybody all the time. Even in this current situation involving President Clinton, my views are acceptable to virtually nobody. I think it's not impeachable and removable. I think the president should not be prosecuted for perjury or anything else because nobody else would be. And I was a federal prosecutor for 7 years and the head of the criminal division in Washington. And I can tell you, nobody would be prosecuted federally for having an extramarital affair and then lying to cover it up. As a matter of fact, until last year, the law was that you could not be prosecuted for perjury simply for denying wrongdoing. The Supreme Court changed that rule last year, but I think they would have done well to leave a carve-out for personal conduct. They didn't, but I think that doctrine in the law still suggests that this is not a cognizable federal criminal case. On the other hand, it does seem to me that it would not be amiss for the president to consider from time to time whether his effectiveness has been very much corroded and undermined, whether people are no longer taking him seriously, whether when he says, please send troops to Kosovo or please support the IMF or even please come to the state dinner in the East Room, are people saying, yes, Mr. President, and looking at him and thinking only about Monica Lewinsky. And thinking that they've been invited to the White House just to be part of the act, to pretend that there's not an elephant standing over in the corner of the room. If he came to the conclusion that that was true, then I think he might pardonably consider the early retirement option.
What's it been like for you over the years to have some strong opinions that differ from the majority of that just about everybody in the Republican Party?
Well, I don't think any individual one of my opinions differs from just about everybody in the party. Maybe the combination is a little unusual, although I think in my generation, the baby boomer generation, it's not that unusual. In a nutshell, my political philosophy is anti-government, pro-individual. In the economic area, that makes me a conservative because I'm in favor of tax cuts. My motto is there's no such thing as government money. There's only taxpayers' money. I was pretty conservative on reforming welfare and on tough sentences in the crime area. On the other hand, you get to other so-called social issues, such as abortion and gay rights. Again, I'm anti-government and pro-individual, which means I want the government not only out of your pocketbook, but also out of your bedroom. To me, that's consistent, and I think the right wing of the Republican Party is the one that's guilty of an inconsistency in suddenly wanting the government to solve all the problems when it reaches issues pertaining to human sexuality. To me, that's a disconnect.
What a lot of politicians fear is that if they support gay rights policies, that they'll get the vote of gay people, but they'll lose a lot of votes in return, and that it's going to be more in the negative numbers, finally, when the results are tallied. How did that do for you? Do you feel like you won more or lost more votes in the long run?
Oh, no. Clearly, you lose more. And, you know, my political staff was well aware every time I took an initiative in the gay rights area that the polls were 10 to 90 against whatever we were going to do, whether it was just, you know, elementary fairness things like letting gay people have rights of visitation in hospitals or, you know, visit children in schools, stuff that you needed an executive order to be able to do. visit somebody, you know, some lifelong partner who's dying in a hospital. I mean, to me, that was not a very difficult decision to make. And I'm amazed that it seems to be as difficult as it does. For just elementary fairness to be extended to gays and lesbians. And you know, it needn't be pecuniary advantage. I mean, I'm not even talking about collecting under life insurance policies. I'm just talking about treating them with dignity. In answer to your political question, gay and lesbian issues poll very badly. My sense is that neither party is ready for those issues at the national level.
My guest is William Weld, former governor of Massachusetts. He's written a new political novel called Mackerel by Moonlight. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is William Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts and a former federal prosecutor. He's written a political novel called Mackerel by Moonlight. Now, I want to get back to the work that you did when you were associate minority counsel for the House Judiciary Committee Nixon impeachment inquiry. Now, you say that you and Hillary Rodham, who were both working together at the time, were given the task of writing grounds for impeachment. At what point in the process were you asked to write that?
Very early on. Hillary Rodham and I were the third and fourth people hired, I believe, in December of 1973 for the staff. And I shall never forget my first Friday there, John Doerr, who was the chief counsel, called me and Hillary Rodham into his office and said, I'd like to have a definition of the grounds for impeachment. Anytime Tuesday would be fine. So We looked in the wrong place. We looked in the law books. I think the right place to look for a definition of what's grounds for impeachment historically would be in the newspapers of the day, so you could find out not only the precise who struck John of the conduct in question, but what the political backdrop was in terms of the temper of the times. But suffice it to say that after many more lawyers than Miss Rodham and myself had looked at this for many more days than the span between a Friday and a Tuesday, they concluded that at one level, the definition of impeachable conduct that had been offered by Congressman Gerry Ford, namely whatever a majority of the House and two-thirds of the Senate says it is, at one level that was a, quote, terse but profound definition, close quote. I think that's a little fast because that implies that you can skip the normative, the prescriptive element of the analysis, namely should a majority of the House or should two-thirds of the Senate say that this conduct constitutes grounds for impeachment or removal. I don't think you can get away from that. So I think you still have to hearken back to the legal backdrop, the English precedents, the American precedents, what constitutes high crimes and misdemeanors.
To what extent do you think that the guidelines that you and your colleagues came up with in the 70s could apply today?
Oh, I think they can apply. I mean, they were quite general. We pointed out that the conduct that's grounds for impeachment and removal need not be a crime. We pointed out that it has to have some connection with the president's discharge of the duties of his office. It can't be purely personal, self-regarding conduct. I think both of those principles apply today.
I'm wondering what things you would most like to ask Ken Starr now about his investigation, if you were able to ask him directly.
Well, I'm in a small minority of people who have been senior Justice Department officials in Washington in that I think we should keep the independent counsel statute. I think the danger of corrosion of the criminal justice function of the government is so great that you have to put up with the relative unfairness of that statute towards the people who were covered by it. The way it works is that there's a small but defined class of federal officials that are covered by the statute that, you know, if they so much as look sideways at somebody, if there's the slightest credible allegation that they may have done something wrong, bingo, you get a special prosecutor, independent counsel, as it's now called, appointed to look into them. Well, that's a, you know, that's much more of a hair-trigger standard than the average citizen would undergo. To compensate for it, the statute says, but you got to finish the investigation in 60 or 90 days, and then Fisher cut bait and determine whether there's something really substantial here to go further.
So I'm wondering if you have any questions about the way Kenneth Starr conducted his investigation. If you think he overstepped his powers, if you have any questions about how he first found out about the Monica Lewinsky story and if he could pursue it.
I don't know the facts of how he first came into possession of that. My impression reading the papers is that he was approached by Linda Tripp, who said, I have these tapes. One of the unfortunate things about the independent counsel statute is that the independent counsel's deliberations and decisions are not conducted with the same degree of secrecy as attends a normal grand jury proceeding. The wonderful thing about being a U.S. attorney, a federal prosecutor, is that you essentially preside over a secret establishment. You don't have people second-guessing you every 30 days or every 10 days saying, how come you haven't indicted so-and-so for such-and-such? Because people generally don't know that you have a grand jury sitting to review so-and-so or such-and-such. When someone is appointed a special prosecutor on page one of every newspaper in the country and everyone knows exactly who they're looking at and what they're looking at them for, that person would be subject to enormous second-guessing if he or she said, well, I'm not even going to go down that alley. So this is not politically correct to say, but I'm not sure that Ken Starr really had the luxury that a normal prosecutor might have had of saying, oh, no, wait a minute, this is about private sexual conduct. We're not going to ask any questions here. And I think there was enough of a suggestion of a possibility of obstruction of justice so that if I'd been his lawyer, I probably would not have advised him to say, no way are we going to even look at this.
Now, you're out of politics for the moment. You resigned from your position as governor of Massachusetts in order to pursue your nomination to the position of ambassador to Mexico. This was a President Clinton nomination. Then when you, under pressure, withdrew your nomination, you were kind of out of politics for a while. Do you wish you were back? Are you anxious to get back in?
No, I've taken a vow of non-poverty for 5 years. Mirroring the number of children of college age that my wife and I have. No, I'm very happy to take a hiatus here. I'm still, you know, friendly with the people who are thinking of running in 2000, and I enjoy hearing their perspective. But I'm trying to keep my nose to the grindstone of business and occasionally produce a work of fiction to keep the mind alive.
William Weld, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. Enjoyed it.
William Weld is the former governor of Massachusetts. He's written a political novel called Mackerel by Moonlight. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publishers of Pete Hamill's tribute to Old Blue Eyes, Why Sinatra Matters, in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.